You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toku ingoa.
Ko sauf toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. Kia ora mea, how are you this week?
Hi, I'm good, how are you?
I'm good, we have a really gorgeous show today, I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm really excited too. I'm really loving what's going on in the art scene right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of
there's
good shows on.
There's a lot of really lovely, exciting, thoughtful, yeah, I'm really excited.
Exactly. It's so good.
Yeah, so be sure to go have a mingle.
For sure.
Mingle about the art scene.
Exactly. Yeah. And what have you got today, Maya?
Yeah, I caught up with Art Space Aotearoa Kaitohu director Ruth Buchanan about Selena Ashadi's The Blue Dome. So what have you got?
I had a kōrero with artist Nico Hinden about her work showing in Cosmologies currently on at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery.
He aha o whakara. We'd love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So toku patahi mai. You can text us on 5395. Rima toru iwa rima. Or why my rane? Give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also after the show, koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō hei pakihere roki roki maronga e te paitokutoku o irirangi poho. Me haere ki 95BFM erakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Cosmologies is a new exhibition at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery, placing the practices of Nico Hinden and Naminapu Meimuru White in conversation with one another as two artists who share an approach to making, whereby cosmology is not a metaphor but a material language, a guiding force led by Indigenous knowledge pathways, a reference to law, memory, navigation, spirit energy, and ecological care. Nico Hinden is a multidisciplinary artist and cultural practitioner. Grounded in Mātauranga Māori shared across generations, her practice reflects ongoing relationships to whakapapa and te taiao, where being is always being in relation, where knowledge is located in the body, in material and in time. The heart of her practice centres on the revitalisation of traditional cultural practices from te ao Māori, concentrating on ote, Māori bark cloth made from the paper mulberry plant as her primary material, a collaborative labour of love in working with ote. Hinden harvests, strips, beats, and soaks its fibres across months into its final cloth-like form. In Cosmologies, Hinden presents three beautiful artworks made of ote, one along the wall mapping stellar movements in alignment with the Maramataka, Māori lunar calendar, and two large quilts hung as crescents encircling Naminapu Meimuru White's works within, creating a constellation of cosmology within the gallery space itself. I had a kōrero with Nico Hinden about Cosmologies and her overall practice.
Kia ora, tēnā tātou, ko Nico tōku ingoa, he uri ahau no te hokianga whakapaukarakia ko ngā pahi ko te raroa ngā iwi. He kiri aute ahau. I am an aute maker, and the word that we came up for that is a kiri aute. And I've been working with aute since 2013 now, and I started practicing full-time as an artist about 8 years ago. I guess my whole life and my whole artistic practice is dedicated to the life cycle of the plant. So I harvest ote during the summertime, and I tend to paint and do more processing during the winter time. And a lot of my practice has been about kind of formalizing or researching specific process that Māori did to make ote. And that comes from researching our old tools and making our old tools in the way that our tūpuna did. I think a lot of my practice is underpinned by a desire to kind of use natural materials, resources that our tūpuna used, and through that I feel like my connection to the environment is strengthened, and also my hononga to my whakapapa and my pepeha. And I guess that is, yeah, really the thing that underpins my practice, is only using natural processes that our tūpuna used. used to use.
In your current exhibition at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery, Cosmologies, your work is placed in conversation with Naminapu Meimuru White as two artists who share an approach to making whereby cosmology is a material language, not just a concept, with yourself working in the context of Matauranga Māori and Meimuru White in Yongu Cosmology. To begin with speaking about the show, I thought we could speak a little to your relationship to these ideas of cosmology, celestial bodies and stars which ground the exhibition. A loaded question, I know, but would you like to speak a little as to what they mean to you personally?
Yeah, that's so beautiful and it's so important to me. Also mention Nami Napu's beautiful work. She's like a Kriya over in Te Whenua Momoia and her work is stunning. And I, you know, they are really our tuakana in many respects, especially with their mātauranga around celestial bodies. And yeah, I guess, where can I start with this question? I think I first started learning about the stars when I lived in Hawaii, and that was through a navigational perspective when I was hanging out with the crew at Sand Island, the Hokulea crew, who were dry docking and sanding hoku to prepare for probably their worldwide voyage. And I was with an apprentice navigator at the time who was training for his their first sail to Tahiti using the star compass or, you know, non-instrumental navigation techniques that he was learning. And so I was just really in the right place at the right time. And I learned, you know, I was hanging out with Nainoa Thompson and Bruce Blankenfield and Ka'iulani Murphy and all these amazing people and learning about the stars. And of course, they're all upside down over there compared to what they look like here. I learned about the star compass, which is the conceptual framework for finding direction from the perspective of being inside a waka. And then the edge of your compass is the horizon, 360 degrees around you, and you use the stars to kind of as anchor points to find where you are and also to calculate speed and distance and kind of keep on your sail plan. So that was where my interest first started in navigation. And then I came back to Aotearoa. I did a few sails in Hawaii, you know, short little sails, and went to Tahiti when Hokulea went to Tahiti. So I was following her around the world. And then when hoku came to Aotearoa, I stumped on hoku from Tāmaki Makaurau to Golden Bay and back up. And that was a really amazing experience, connecting with also all of the other Aotearoa crews and waka. And that was a really special time in my life. And then I guess I also, from those experiences and just seeing the power of Hokulea, I started to work with Ōte and kind of reclaim that mātauranga, because I guess I saw the value of what it was to create, of like the movement of reclamation of knowledge and how that built community and was really powerful, made a really powerful impact on people's sense of identity and connection to the identity. It created something physical for people to do. And that was had a really big impact on me. And then when I started working with Ōte and sort of started learning more about the whetū and our Māori names and our stories around the stars. And then I read Rangi Mātāmua's book, Matariki, which is really important. And we, you know, Matariki is coming up. And in that book, I realized, oh, there are some stars that are related to the maramataka, or how do I say it, like the months of the year were signified by morning stars. Just like Matariki signifies the first month of the year, then there's Te Rua or Takura, which is Sirius, which signifies the second month of the year, and so on and so forth. And so while I knew some of these stars, like Takuru and Potu Te Rangi, I didn't know other stars like Painga Whawha. And I guess this series of star maps that I have in the gallery at the moment is an extension of my learning about navigation. And this time it's also learning about what I kind of call land stars, which we use to count time. So I think the main thing with these star maps and creating these star maps, I guess they are, I've used them throughout my learning journey to help me learn first the star compass and then the declination of stars, so where the stars rise and which house they belong to. And then going on from that, what stars are rising during what time of the year. So I introduced a time element, and then this series is looking at the way that all of the stars move throughout the whole year. So when you look at them as a body of work, you can see, oh, the stars are rising earlier and earlier each month, and these are the stars that are coming up in the morning, and this is how it changes throughout the year. So those are like seasonal indicators. And I guess I think it became important to me to learn these because, as Rangi Matanua always says, you know, one of the greatest and most significant things that colonization did to us was it disconnected us from our sense of time and space. So it disconnected us from these signals that the environment gives us that indicate the seasonal changes. So, you know, like when the mullet are running, or when the pūtawa are blooming, or when kōwhai are blooming, or, you know, all of those little things, as well as the stars, which stars are rising, those help us tell the time. Mm. But now we have a imported system of time, the Gregorian calendar, and we have kind of lost our connection to those other symbols of time. And I think it's, for me, I'm wanting to learn so that I can be more connected to my pepeha and my environment and, yeah, my cultural identity as a wahine Māori.
Your practice is incredibly materially driven, centering this reinvigoration of traditional cultural practices from Te Ao Māori, using ote Māori bark cloth made from the paper mulberry plant. If I can take you back to when you first approached working with this material, what first drew you to ote?
That's a great question. I think what I love about ote is how physical it is, and how you have to really engage in the plant. The way that the plant grew impacts how it transforms into cloth. And I guess in having to engage in all of these environmental factors that kind of come out in the cloth and are represented there in the cloth, and then you being this instrument to help the cloth, the bark, then transform into cloth, and how physically demanding that process is as well for my body. I think I was really interested in just that process of transformation, the science in it. And I guess you, as with a lot of processes, more material processes in Te Ao Māori, you're always like, wow, how did our tūpuna work this out? You know, this is amazing. And I think just the depth of that knowledge is never ending, and you can really continue to learn. And I've been doing this for 13 years, and I continue to learn from the plant, and I continue to learn these processes. And I am always, learning new things about, you know, how our tūpuna would have, you know, made these little adjustments to the tools to improve the process slightly, you know. And our tools are so crucial, and they would have all been made, you know, using hoanga, sandstone, using shark's teeth to make grooves, and ponamu and toki, and yet the tools were so efficient, and they were made in very specific ways. Even a millimeter difference in the shape can make a huge difference in the way that you process the ote. So I guess I just love discovering, or, you know, relearning all of those things. And I think for me as well, when I'm physically, you know, just the same as when I'm sure like voyagers and navigators are sailing on waka, you know, you're living it. You're living the practice, and you're living it. And I think that makes us feel closer to our tūpuna when we're working with these materials and these tools.
You kind of spoke to it a little bit there, but I can imagine it is quite an immersive, sometimes collaborative and certainly bodily experience working with ote, harvesting, stripping, beading and soaking the fibres into their final form that we see in the show. You spoke a little to your process there, but how much of your process then feels like, I guess, a relinquishment of control and letting the material lead you? When do you know when the process of turning the ote into this cloth-like material is complete?
That's so funny. I think I always get nervous before a project when I say, oh yes, I'm going to do this, because at the end of the day I don't know if I'll necessarily be able to achieve the idea in the way that I've kind of constructed it in my mind. And I think that is why ote, you know, processing ote is such a humbling practice, because it is collaborative. And there's so many factors and during the process. For example, the ote's relationship with water and how long it's soaked in the water changes how soft the fibers are and how much they can be folded, or if maybe they can't be folded and stretched and beaten in that way. So there's a lot of different factors that influence the way the pieces turn out. And I always think, you know, when I'm in the beading phase and the harvesting phase, you're really on ote time. Whatever else you're doing in your life really has to take a back seat, because the priority is always got to be processing your ote. And I think for me, it's really important, especially in Aotearoa, where trees are, they're not scarce, but, you know, I value and I treasure every single tree that I harvest, and I don't want anything to go to waste. So ensuring that I honour each plant and respect each plant and try and let it live its best life is really important, or else you're just, you know, cutting down a tree and you're wasting it. And that's not really part of my philosophy. But also, you know, within our harvesting tikanga, our harvesting protocols that, you know, come from Te Whare Pōra, which is the House of Fibre Arts that Harakeke belongs to, you know, we have a lot of tikanga around the correct way to do things, which is really important to follow, and something that I try and pass on to all of my tauira, my apprentices and the students that I teach. I'm always emphasising the importance of following tikanga, and then your integrity as a maker is your capacity, your ability to kind of stick to that and honour the rākau.
What I think is really cool, I guess, adding on to that, is reading the hanging ote cloth works from behind, or like seeing them backlit. I really noticed it in the show. I felt like it made such a difference as a viewer to really see those fibers and the stitching and a bit of that process with a lot more clarity. In presenting the works, was that intentional in installing them, that the viewer can really encounter and engage with them from every angle?
Yeah, I think when I presented the quilt the first time in Sao Paulo at the Sao Paulo Biennale in 2023, I hung it, that pavilion has these beautiful windows and this beautiful natural light that kind of pulls through, and I hung this piece, and I think it looked really beautiful because it was backlit by the natural light. And I think in the show, it is really beautiful how you can kind of walk all around the pieces. And we kind of made it so that the pieces are curved and encircle the ote and encircle Ngāmi Napu's work, just to emphasize, you know, the cyclical nature of time and our celestial bodies and the way that they move, and also our hina, our moon, and all of her faces and phases that she goes through. So I feel like a really important part of these works, these quilts, is the transparency of being transparent about the labor that's involved in them, and being able to see all of the trees, because these quilts are about labor, collective labor, material transformation, but these works have really honest works. So all the pieces are beaten, or what I call freshly beaten, so beaten straight from the tree, and they are kind of quite raw. So you can see all of the side branches and all of the holes and the whole life of the plant. And some of the trees are really, really big. And so some of the cloths are really big as well. And they've all just been sewn together as they are. And then a grid has been applied over the top of them, as if it's a quilt. So there's this combination of the kind of organic pieces sewn together and then this grid kind of being overlaid on top of it. So yeah, and I should mention that my friend Katie Middleton, who I met to Elam with and who was also a student of Matua Dante Bonica, who just recently passed away, she made all of the aho muka, which is the cordage, and on the large piece, which is called Te Ahu Rewa Ohine Tiwiwa, it's got about 200 meters of muka aho cordage.
Wow.
That she herself, yeah, and that's what is used to sew all of the pieces together. Yeah, so there's a lot of labor involved, but also these works speak to that relationship between the ote and the muka, because there are some processes that overlap within the process of extracting muka and also in the process of peeling and processing the ote.
You kind of spoke to it a little bit at the beginning when we were talking about cosmology more generally, but there is this beautiful work along the wall in the show which charts stellar movements in alignment with the Maramataka, where here cosmology is not a metaphor but a method. In that work, you've hand-painted onto the ote using natural pigments and designs informed by customary Māori forms to mark these movements in alignment with the Maramataka. Would you be able to speak a little to this process of mark making and what informs the final form in this painted element of the work in relation to cosmology as a method of making?
Yes, sure. Big question. I think I'll start off by saying the main difference between the quilt and the process I've used to process the ote in the quilt, and also the way that I've processed the pieces that I've painted, is that the pieces in the quilt have been through a single beading process, and then the pieces on the wall have been soaked and they've been retted or fermented, and then they are two pieces beaded together, and that's why there's no holes in them. And then the texture is quite different. It's much more like a texture, like a papery texture. And then the marks on these ote, or the tauira, they come from Taniko and Tukutuku. That's the lineage of those marks. And that's because these patterns come from a weaving traditions, which are wahine patterns. And of course, are, you know, woven with the hands of our wahine Māori. And that was always really important when I first started to make ote, was to think about, oh, what are the appropriate marks, what are the appropriate tauira to be applying to this ote, because we have no examples in any of our museums. So I was the first, and I felt like that was quite an important decision and distinction to make at the time, because I felt like I was, you know, setting a precedent. And also the star maps, they kind of came about because at the time I was learning about navigation in Hawaii, and it took me a long time to start painting on the ote. It took me 5 years to learn how to vaguely make the cloth, and then I started painting on it after that. So I had a long time to think about it, and the star maps came about as a device to, as I said before, to learn about the star houses. And conceptually, this in the star compass, they say that the stars, they live in houses underneath the horizon. So for example, Matariki and Hokulea, they live in the star house of Kāinga in the northern quadrant. And, you know, these stars rise from the house and then they travel across the sky, and depending on your latitude will depend on the angle that the stars will cross the sky, and then they'll sink back into their star house on the western horizon, but the same star house. And so the star maps were to help me memorize which stars belonged in which houses. And so each line is the declination, so it relates to their degrees. So for example, Tautoru, Orion's Bow, rises exactly 0 degrees east, And then Hokulea is like 24 degrees north of east. And yeah, so every star has its own declination, and that is in relation to the lines. And I think for me, making the star maps, it was kind of a predetermined design. And I liked that, having this decisions kind of taken away from me. The lines were there where they were in the sky, you know, and the Niho represented the star houses. And yeah, and I guess you can see the pattern across the year in the way the stars move or rise at different times, because that each star, where it's placed on its line, is determined by the time that it either rises or the time that it sets. So yeah, that's sort of my philosophy or my methodology around the star maps. And then they are, yeah, ultimately just tools to learn about our calendar system, our stellar lunar calendar, and our Fetu, and the new Fetu that I had to learn to make these star maps.
And lastly, do you have any hopes for viewers engaging with the show?
I think the main purpose of these works and the star maps is to help people understand that a Māori concept of time is different from the Gregorian calendar, and to also recognise that Matariki isn't the only important star in our cosmologies, that we have other significant stars that represent other things. And also, I guess, to try and connect with, you know, not just our Fetu, not just our stars as indicators of time, but also you can still do it living in Tamaki Makaurau, you know, noticing when the Manuka are blooming, or when Kōwhai are blooming, or is there a yellow Pohitikawa tree somewhere that you've noticed, or, you know, what are the birds doing at certain times, or when do the ducklings walk across the road? I guess there's all of these kinds of factors that we can all notice in our environment that will help us become more connected to the taiao and the place where we live, and also, I guess, the place that we should be trying to give back to.
That was artist Nico Hinden speaking to me about her current joint exhibition with Naminapu Meimuru White at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery, Cosmologies. The exhibition is on now until the 9th of August, so be sure to go check it out.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
You're listening to Various Artists on BFM. We'll be right back.
Good art.
The Blue Dome by Selena Urshadi is ArtSpace Aotearoa's current exhibition, which continues in the gallery's exploration of their annual question, Which History? Selena Urshadi is an Iranian-born, Tamaki-based artist who primarily works amongst a practice of experimental filmmaking and writing, drawing from personal histories and lineages of storytelling through acts of documentation and the navigation of familial archives. Within the Blue Dome, Urshadi presents various forged visual material and audio that draw from her two recent trips back to Tehran, constructing these complex autobiographical works that speak to moments of lived reality and attempts of self-orientation. Although autobiographical in nature, these works complicate this idea of the linear narrative of autobiographical filmmaking and storytelling, shifting the linear concept and framework of the documentary through Urshadi's experimental approach to the capturing of imagery and dialogues, as well as the construction of the film itself, allowing for these slips of failure to seep into the captured frame, resulting in a documentation that questions its own stability of account. But through this instability, moments of reception appear. These intimate works that draw from Urshadi's familial histories become open to a kind of reception, an intertwining of spaces, dialogues, and histories. I caught up with ArtSpace Aotearoa's Kaitohu director, Ruth Buchanan, about the exhibition.
Kia ora, ko Taranaki Tamunga, ko Ringatoi nei, ko Kaitohu o ArtSpace Aotearoa nei, ko Ruth Buchanan aho. My name is Ruth and I'm Kaitohu Director of ArtSpace Aotearoa on Karangahape Road.
ArtSpace Aotearoa's current exhibition, The Blue Dome, features a new body of work by Tamaki-based artist and filmmaker Selena Urshadi. I'd like to start off this conversation by speaking a little bit to the artist herself. Would you be able to introduce the artist and a bit of her overall practice for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, we're really excited to be presenting the first institutional solo of Selena. She's shown pretty widely across Aotearoa and also most recently at the BFI Film Festival in London, which is a really significant festival in that context for artist filmmakers. So I guess her presence in the city in the form of a solo show is really, really timely. She has a background in both English literature and masters in fine art. So I guess what's constant in her work is this relationship between looking and listening, or language and the image. And I think that she's really sort of developed that to exciting new level for this current show. And what's really exciting about it is that it will be touring as well. So two international venues, Nottingham Contemporary in the UK next year, as well as works, elements of the show will be included at the 17th Asia Pacific Triennale in Brisbane next year as well. So I think that's just a reflection of the timeliness of her way of working, as I say, navigating a sort of tension or not between this looking and this listening impulse.
And within the Blue Dome, Urshadi presents various foraged audio and visual material from her recent trips back to Tehran, constructing these works that speak to this lineage of storytelling and an attempt of self-orientation. Would you be able to, for our listeners, walk us through the works presented in this exhibition, as well as a little bit on the context surrounding them?
Yeah, no, I will speak from the perspective of ArtSpace Aotearoa rather than Selena, so take what I'm saying with a grain of salt. But I suppose this show sits as the second part of our 2026 program, which orients itself around the question, which history, ko tihia hitori. And I think the other way to think about that question, which history, is where does my attention go and why does my attention go there? And I think that question of attention and constructing attention is really potent within the exhibition, which consists of four key works. The Blue Dome, which is a 28-minute montage film shot on both 16mm and Selena's iPhone. As you said, shot in Tehran over two separate visit she's made in the last 18 months, where she's in conversation with her grandmother, her grandmother, great aunt, and aunt. The other film, An Eye Open, is a really incredible portrait of her mother, really, and it's this close image of her mother's eye as it's been cared for by the medical system here in Aotearoa. And it's a medical imaging. There's found footage that's included in the show as well. And then there's a really fantastic sound piece that she's made together with Francis Lebeau called Passage, which is sort of the orientation or the start point for the show. So she's talked about it as a sonic curtain. So I guess going back to that question of attention, there's these really clear moments in the show where she asks us to question how we listen and question how we look. So this sonic curtain is made up of cassette recordings from family members talking in 1980 and then family members listening to that material today and trying to sort of decipher which aunt is that, what were they saying, where was this recorded, as well as field recordings from Tiran. But it does this really beautiful thing of bringing that world of her family, her whānau, Tiran, into our whare on Karangahape Road, but at the same time it welcomes the sounds of the street outside the gallery in as well. So I think the exhibition is really sophisticated in terms of its capacity to bring the world into the work and also show us that the work in the exhibition is from and part of the world.
Yeah, that was my next question. Something that I found really personally intriguing about the exhibition is that awareness of the space through that really thoughtful installation of the work itself, specifically in relation to the work Passage, which you were just speaking about, which is the work of first encounter and also the last upon exit. Yeah, it takes on this kind of act as a prelude of sorts to the wider exhibition, while also leaning into this liminal space between Karangahape Road and the work itself, resulting in this really wonderful fugue of intertwining sound and audio. I wanted to ask a little bit behind the thought process of the installation of the exhibition. Was there something that Selena herself or you also in conversation kind of spoke about, that the installation and mingling of those worlds?
Yeah, I mean, we from the very beginning spoke very much about this exhibition opportunity as a chance to think film, think sound into the space and towards a visiting body. Of course, it's quite common if you're working in film, the impulse might be to try and say, within this contemporary art gallery, let's try and make it as if it's a cinema. But rather than doing that impossible act of creating cinema-style scenario within a contemporary art gallery, which has a very different type of architecture and infrastructure, rather than that leaning into what our space could offer Selena's work, and I guess I'm thinking about the exhibition itself as a film. So how can a show be like a film, and how can we support or sort of invite audience to have some element of self-efficacy in there, that as they move through the space they are editing, so as you enter the space and you carry the sounds you've left behind from Karangahape Road with you and you pass through that sonic threshold, that's sort of an act of live editing. We've worked with a mesh curtain, very deep, rich colours, quite particular shaped furnitures. So there's many opportunities to be an effective editor as an audience member. So both of us talked a lot. We talked a lot about that from the beginning of our working process. And I guess we were interested in the ways that things that happen inside the film might also happen in the exhibition space. So, for example, in the Blue Dome, there are a lot of shots with views, into other views. So what am I saying? Perhaps a camera angle that we see a doorway, and then through the doorway we see a window, and then through the window we can see part of Tehran city outside. So there's this sort of stacking of spatial experience, and we've tried to take some of those filmic decisions into the space in terms of, like I say, using that curtaining. So there's a layer of access, working with archways and negative space to create that sort of sense of perspective, and keeping some of our windows to the street open as well. So as you look at the film with these layered views of Tehran city, when you turn around, you have that same experience in the gallery out onto Karangahape Road as well. So I feel really excited by where we got with the exhibition, and definitely excited by it as a proposal for how film can take on board the liveness of an exhibition. Contingency of visiting a show, and it's a very different thing than being in a cinema, right? Your sort of contract is quite different as a visitor.
Yeah, it's so beautiful to see a film presented in this capacity where it's so open to its surroundings and really taking on this interconnected nature within the gallery space itself.
You talked about the word susceptible, you know, that the work could be susceptible to the world in the same way as the world is susceptible to the work, and I really think that's a strength.
Yeah, like a weaving together of these different kind of points. And also on the note of Selena's film, The Blue Dome, although this film displays an insight into Oshadi's personal moments of dialogue and domestic familial imagery, there is also this undertone of a lack of linear storytelling, a lack of orientation as one enters the viewing of the film, not quite knowing their point of entry in relation to the film itself. It seems as though Oshadi is really playing with this notion of the linear and the unreliable author through the film's fragmented construction and the alternative endings. Are you able to speak a little bit to the film's fragmented construction and the kind of lack of orientation it passes over to the viewer?
Yeah, I mean, I think like all editing, whether we're editing a film or a music album or a piece of writing, it's just as much about what we leave out as what we include. And I think that tension is something that Selena is really excited by, but also confident and pushing to an edge as well. So I think I probably wouldn't use the term unreliable narrator, but yeah, there's an interest in eschewing sort of standards around what it looks like to tell a story, how our apparatus for telling those stories are ordinarily asked to perform. So thinking about the way the microphone shows up, or you know, that appears in several scenes. We see the microphone on the table between these two older women having a conversation, or the shakiness of the camera. And I don't think it's not done in any kind of mannered way at all. I mean, for me, it's fundamentally perhaps like what a real documentary would look like, right? Is when we understand that there are many, 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 many versions of every story. And I think what I find interesting and exciting about what you're raising in this question in terms of like, oh, it's where do I orient? What's the timeline? How am I traveling along from like the perspective of Hannah Arendt, you know, philosopher? She talks about conversation and dialogue as being key, absolutely key tools to avoid authoritarianism. So if we take that attitude to looking at a film, that on the one hand we literally listen into and see conversations, but we're also invited into something that's more like a figure eight than a straight line, there is really that sense of the work having a conversational structure that I think becomes very inclusive and definitely anti-authoritarian, which I think is a really powerful statement to make at this moment, particularly when it's done in this rather understated way. Yeah.
And I also wanted to touch on the great array of reading material that Oshadi has included within the exhibition. I think this is such a lovely way to recognize the creative references and lineages of a work and practice as a whole. The material Oshadi has chosen includes a variety of poetry and memoirs, writing with all kind of a open and liminal approach to language. Language itself that perhaps mimics the ways in which Oshadi approaches her own filmmaking. Are you able to speak a little bit to the interconnected nature between Oshadi's film practice and these writing references and also her practice in relation to language?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I mentioned, she has that sort of dual background training through English literature and going to art school. So from the very emergence of her artistic practice, language, the reading of text, the production of text, the listening to it has been central to what she does. And I think in the exhibition we encounter that in a number of ways. You know, there are subtitles, which I think it's important for us to always have in mind. These are never, you know, one-to-one exacting versions of what we're hearing. That's a way of working through stability of language and capacity to understand. In the VHS material, there's a timestamp on that, so that's also text, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for both Selena and I, we both adore reading, and a lot of our, you know, most beautiful conversations in these last 18 months as we've worked together or worked towards this show has been around sharing what we're reading. Selena has an incredible memory for authors' quotes, where they said this, when they said that. It's kind of encyclopedic and it's an amazing thing to be around. So I guess mutually we agreed that it would be really wonderful to bring that specificity into the exhibition. It's also, the books are located in our reading room where we always do have texts available that resonate with the show in some way, but usually it's selected by me or Matthew or whoever has curated the show. But in this instance, because there's such a strong affinity with language and a real understanding the material power of text and publications, it felt really generous of Selena to bring in her personal library. And I think it sort of underscores that sense, you know, you mentioned it earlier, the access we have to personal, intimate moments, but there is a reticence, there is a holding back, there is a editing. So I think there's a really interesting tension about what we show, what we don't show, and where it's set up in the gallery. It's pretty, it's dark, it's low light, so it does create this really beautiful one-to-one encounter opportunity that's quite different to the scale of the film, right? Which is like, you know, 3 meters by 4 meters. It's large, the sound is loud. So we also were thinking very much about, yeah, how do I get close to this range of materials in a different in a range of ways.
Yeah, it's such a beautiful and also generous addition to the show, which I personally really appreciate, and I think it's really lovely to also there being Ashadi's personal books. It's got that secondary layer of like the that intimate connection, and kind of you can make those links between the films as you walk around, and kind of makes you hover in that space a little longer and sit with the work through these different, yeah, like rather than being specifically engaged in the film itself, it's like you can be in the corner reading the book while still overhearing the works in the background, which I think is really special.
Yeah, I mean, she, in the whole making of the show, and I'm not going to be able to remember the author she was quoting from, but she talked about the sidelong glance, so accessing a thing, you know, not from the centre, not from the front, but from a sort of a skewed or side angle. And I think what you've just described as the viewing experience where you might be reading something but you hear the grandma's voice in the background, that throughout the show there's this, yeah, this sort of glimpsing and glazing across of access.
Yeah, this kind of idea of orbiting a point from these different different locations in a way. And lastly, what are your hopes for viewers engaging with this exhibition?
Well, you know, we always, ultimately what we're offering at ArtSpace Aotearoa is catalyst. You know, every exhibition that we do, every artwork that we show, every event that we hold, what we hope is that someone who comes along might have a new thought, a feeling. Perhaps they will think about it in 2 years' time. Perhaps it's immediate. But I think just on a very surface level, in the specific case of Selena's show and its proximity to the current global tumult in terms of the war in Iran, it offers an antidote to a very, very flat media landscape that's predicated primarily on monologue and extreme saturation and binary viewpoints. I think just at this very, you know, this moment, completely unplanned, of course, on our case, we've been working on this show for a much longer period of time. It offers texture, it confidently sort of presents ambiguity, it is okay with nuance, and I feel those are all things that are really valuable to build our muscles around this year. And, you know, for us in Aotearoa heading towards elections later this year, wouldn't it be amazing if there was more chance to think in texture, to think in ambiguity together, so that we can have friction without fragmentation? So I think there's a real potency to viewing Selena's work right now.
That was ArtSpace Aotearoa Kaitohu director Ruth Buchanan speaking to me about Selena Oshadi's The Blue Dome, which is on until the 4th of July. Also in association with the exhibition, there will be a screening of Fugue Notes by Selena Oshadi, along with an introduction and reading of the script by the artist. This is a free event taking place at ArtSpace Aotearoa on Thursday, the 25th of June, between 6 and 8 p.m. You can RSVP through the ArtSpace website.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
We'll be right back with your arts guide. Keep it on the B.
You.
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists. It's paintings and that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau, as mentioned on the show, Nico Hinden and Naminapu Meimuru White's Cosmologies is on at Te Uru Waitakere Contemporary Gallery until the 9th of August.
As also mentioned on the show, The Blue Dome by Selena Ushadi is on at Artspace Aotearoa until the 4th of July.
Ma Sheng Fung Ho, a solo exhibition by Audrey Goggin, is on at Window Gallery until the 24th of June.
Brunel Diaz Prim's solo exhibition Mysterium Rationis is on at Grace Aotearoa until the 13th of June.
On at Season Aotearoa is two exhibitions, If I Offered You My Fingernails, Would You Take Them by Melanie Tangaire Baldwin and Colouring in Stone by Monique Schreiger. Both are on until the 27th of June.
Studies for a Keepsake, an exhibition showing Claude Cahoon and Marcel Moore, is on now at Gus Fisher Gallery until the 22nd of August. Also on at Gus Fisher is a solo exhibition by Lucy Mayle, Phone Tree, also on until the 22nd of August. If you have something you want on the Arts Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa e kore o mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us today.
Nico Hinden.
And Ruth Buchanan.
Nei rā, hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95BFM.com or check out our Instagram at 95BFM various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātaua te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove. My name is Soph.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.